Don't laugh.
Hi, and welcome to Drawing Blood. I'm Emma Merkling.
And I'm Christy Slobogan.
And this is a podcast about art and the macabre.
So we're both art historians, early career researchers, and we are both really interested in the intersection between art or visual culture and the history of science, technology, medicine, the occult, death. We're just defining all of that as the macabre. So that's what Drawing Blood is about.
We started this podcast because one of the things that tends to happen the further you get along in academia is your research area becomes increasingly narrowed. And we wanted to remember why we enjoy doing what we do.
And what excites us about what we do. So, you know, as we're going through these episodes, we'll each be picking something that we find fascinating and thinking through it. So it's all very, you know, we're figuring it out.
It's discussive. It's dialectic. We have range.
Exactly.
So we're going to bring an object or an idea sort of to the table and talk it through.
We have a range of topics that we're going to cover in this first season. So everything from surrealist photographs of severed breasts to the testing of spiritual mediums and their ectoplasm to a discussion of Andy Warhol's cosmetic surgery. So basically our topics sit at the juncture of visual culture, the macabre, and the history of science and medicine.
I specialize in the intersection between art history, visual culture, occult history, and history of science, sort of from the late 19th to early 20th century period.
And then I specialize in the visual culture of surgery, particularly in the 20th century. And I also look at women artists, the history of emotions, and trauma.
But we're going to try to talk about things that are outside of our area of expertise too, because that sort of experimentation is important to us and gets us to talk about things that we don't get to talk about anymore, you know, which made us interested in becoming art historians in the first place.
Pursuing these long degrees
in
the first place.
Yeah, I didn't want to say career, because that's like a really bold word for what's going on in my life
exactly,
right now.
Exactly. We are trying to have fun with some difficult topics as we go forward.
Yeah, and to that end, it's probably worth just a general content warning for the series as a whole. You know, we will be talking about issues that people might find upsetting or disturbing. You know, we'll cover bodily mutilation, we'll cover rape, we'll talk about incest.
And I mean, a lot of the images themselves, even if it's a routine surgery, can be upsetting to people. So, you know, obviously this is an audio project, but we will be describing these things in detail and linking to the images in the show notes. So just as Emma said, you know, a general content warning.
But I think one of the things that we'll see as we go through these images and as we go through the course of the series is that what's upsetting about these photos, about these images, is often what's also most interesting about them. And also that there's a lot of feelings that come up in relation to them, often ones that seem inappropriate, but that's interesting and that's art historically relevant. And that's one of the things we're hoping to explore.
Yeah, we'll be talking about feelings a lot.
All right, so you ready? Let's get started. So today, for our very first episode, we're going to be talking about severed breasts.
Yeah, so there are two photographs that I've been wanting to talk about for a really long time, and they are by the American photographer Lee Miller, who was born in 1907 and died in 1977. So we do want to give a content warning that the images themselves are quite difficult or disturbing to look at. But in addition to that, we will also be talking about sexual trauma, sexual assault, and incest.
And just to add, as always, all images we talk about will be linked to in our show notes and will also be available on our website. So, Christy, what are we looking at?
All right, so here are the photographs that we have, which are called Untitled, in brackets, Severed Breasts from Radical Surgery in a Place Setting 1 and 2.
So I guess the first thing to do is just describe the image
I
suppose this is an auditory medium. So the place setting, I guess, refers quite literally to a table setting. Mm-hmm. Like there's a plate, a knife and a fork.
And a spoon.
And a
dessert spoon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On a sort of folded out napkin place setting on a table. It's like a portrait photo, the plate slightly off center. And in the middle, there's something that looks sort of like a hunk of meat, but it's a black and white photo. So it looks grisly, but it's kind of hard to see what it is, I guess would be my first impression. And it's a bit, I mean, even without the title, it's a bit unsettling.
Yeah, definitely.
As a photo. Like, it looks like maybe not a heart necessarily, but some bodily tissue.
Or it like looks organ. Like something that shouldn't be eaten
yeah. on a plate. It looks like it shouldn't be on a plate.
Yeah.
Although it also looks a bit like a burger or something.
And it looks a little, especially in the second image, it looks a lot like mincemeat to me.
Or even chocolate cake.
Yeah.
Like a
yeah.
really poorly cut Ooh, piece of cake.
Like the really juicy chocolate cake from Matilda, the movie.
Yes. yeah. That everyone has a fetish about that they yes. like can't get rid of. Which is like to Disney or whoever
exactly.
put out that movie.
I think the interesting thing about these two images together, which I'm not entirely sure if they were meant to be together. She never published them during her lifetime. Mm. So some people talk about them as a pair and as a diptych, but then some people talk about them as just images in their own right. And I think it's interesting that in the first one, you can see the hint of the nipple, which is the thing that makes it recognizable.
Oh, didn't even see that.
Yeah.
Can we zoom in?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
So that's where you can see what it's supposed to be, and it becomes, you know, representative of the whole body that's not there. But then in the second image, in number two, the breast is turned away. So you have the open flesh that would have connected to the body facing you as the viewer. And it becomes something a lot more abstract. And that's what we're talking about, where it looks like mincemeat or chocolate pudding or okay. something that's not a breast.
So I have quite a basic question. Mm-hmm. Is it actually a breast?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Damn,
that even though it's kind of a disturbing image, that kind of changes how you feel about it mm-hmm. when you look at it. I just assumed it wasn't.
Right.
Like, I assumed it was allegorical.
Well, still is. Right?
Yeah.
but yeah, no, I know what you mean. So it's kind of a ridiculous story in a lot of ways. But so Lee Miller, what she's known for is not, you know, any sort of medical imagery or, you know, she's not really known for tying to the themes of what this podcast is going to be. But she's more known for her surrealist imagery, which you can see that this is surrealist imagery. And she's known probably just initially as working with Man Ray. It's the classic, you know, muse, lover, gets, you know, gypped for a lot of her ideas kind of relationship. And so when she was working with Man Ray in Paris in 1929, she was supplementing her income by also being a fashion model, which she's also quite well known for. Mm. Working with French Vogue, and apparently taking photographs at a hospital in Paris.
So when did you say this photo is from again?
1929.
Okay.
And so, you know, I'm not sure exactly which hospital it's in, because sources say different ones, but it doesn't really matter. And she was observing this mastectomy, and just as a side note, if someone wants to fund a research trip for me to go to Paris and find Lee Miller's other surgical images, I would die. Like...
Is there like a dedicated Lee Miller archive in Paris?
In Farley's, which is in Sussex, where she moved with Roland Penrose. And so she was at this hospital observing this mastectomy, and she asked the surgeon after the operation if she could just take it home with her. And he said yes.
Okay.
Which, you know, today wouldn't really pass.
Like... I'm like, did you ever have your tonsils out?
Yes.
Did they let you take them home?
No. I
didn't even know it was an option because I was too young. But subsequently, I've heard of people who were allowed to take their tonsils home. And obviously, because I'm me, I would have loved that.
You know? I didn't know that was an option either.
It's sort of weird that it's someone else's breast.
Exactly.
Which I guess, yeah.
And it, of course, I wonder...
Did she consent?
Probably not.
Yeah.
You know, the idea, or at least in my head... This woman didn't even come around from surgery until after Lee Miller had already taken it away, you know? Right. And then she just wakes up and her breast is gone in more ways than one. Which is upsetting, again, you know, if you're looking at this image, kind of thinking about that backstory.
I guess the first thing, remind me to come, I'm going to come back around to the question of the woman who sort of woke up.
Yeah.
But I guess, first of all, just because I don't know if people are familiar, maybe it's worth saying something about surrealism and Lee Miller. Because, I mean, you said it's a very obviously surrealist image, and I totally agree. And I think it is and it isn't. Like, surrealism is so famously macho, at least in sort of how you're taught it. And this is so
not.
Well,
but it is.
Whether or not it is, I guess, yes. It's debatable, but it's like, it's not a toe that looks like a dick, you know? Yes. Like, it's like...
I want to finish the story of how it got here. Basically, she was working, as I said, she was working at French Vogue, and she just walked through the streets of Paris with this, with the cloth over it.
So she took it, so this photo's taken out of the hospital.
Yeah, out of the hospital, at the studios at French Vogue. She only managed to set it up and get two shots off before someone kicked her out. And then, like, what did she do with the rest afterwards? I have no idea.
So she was working at Vogue at the time, mm-hmm. but she wasn't just allowed to use the studio.
Well, not for this.
Right.
Not for a lump of human flesh. Yeah. But then in terms of why this is a surrealist image, I mean, what are your thoughts about how this connects to the, you know, surrealism as a movement?
A few thoughts. Like, surrealism was my other sort of focus. I mean, I do Victorian art mostly. Now I'm sort of segueing into late 19th, early 20th century, it is more my thing. But in undergrad, I did, you know, I found myself writing about surrealism a lot because I understand what I'm into, which is sort of like a cult in history of
it
science.
It makes a lot of sense.
Like, yeah. There are these little links and then
absolutely
symbolism, which is some of the art I do now. But I would say that, you know, I mean, surrealists are no, firstly, it's a photograph, and the surrealism I always focused on was photography in this way, but it's sort of the, I don't know. I mean, it's the it's the mundane strangeness of it.
Yeah, it's uncanny.
For sure it's uncanny.
It's something really recognizable and something incredibly unrecognizable mashed into one image.
I guess that's what I sort of meant about the mundane. Is that on the one hand, it looks like a not even very good food photograph.
Yeah. Looks like crap English food.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Haggis. I mean, yeah. Black pudding. Not that those are crap, just that it's the dark, you know, it's the like, yeah, the dense, and then no veg, you know?
Yeah, like, yeah, but, yeah.
But yeah, sort of the almost, I mean, I guess this is kind of not surreal. Well, it's kind of straight photograph,
mm-hmm.
which is quite surprising, I think. You know, it's not, there's no painterly effects.
No solarization.
Like, no.
Which she helped to discover with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With so that, that being the technique where I think you turn on a light when the photograph is being taken.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a sort of hazy outline. But then you also think of, I really should have looked up some of the titles of these Man Ray works, but there's the famous one where it's a neck, possibly her neck. I don't remember looking.
It is Lee Miller's neck. Yeah.
And it's quite abstract, you know, it's the body, but it's sort of cropped and framed in this abstract way. Mm-hmm. And then of course there's all the themes of the abject.
Absolutely. Yes. To all of that in terms of why it's surrealist. You know, one of the other things that we see in surrealist art a lot is kind of the fragmentation and objectification of body parts, of especially women's body parts. So of course, usually that's a male artist doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lee Miller in a way is doing the same thing, but in a less obviously artistic manner where you crop the neck or you blow up someone's lips and put it in the sky or, you know, focus on breasts or the vulva or whatever. She's instead taken a literal fragmentation of a woman's body and stuck it in her surrealist piece of art.
So the fragmenting is, it's physical and literal. It's not imaged. It's not a cropping.
Exactly.
It's not an artistic device. Although what's interesting is, you know, the way that this sort of discussion is going, I guess, is that that might in some way be a feminist or proto-feminist move. Although instinctively, I feel myself pushing against that.
I totally know what you mean.
You know, I mean, it's an unbelievably violent
mm-hmm.
image, and it becomes one of those cases, and maybe we can get into this more later after sort of talking about the object more, but I don't know that just because a woman took the photo, it makes it any less visceral or violent, and as we said, sort of, you know, who is the woman whose
sitting,
breast it is.
Sitting in the hospital while this is being taken.
I'd weirdly feel different if the biographical detail, if it was Lee Miller's breast.
Yes.
And it was sort of a coming to terms with the loss of that I know a lot of women experience.
Yes.
When they've had mastectomies, but yeah.
No, I totally know what you mean. And I think there's, you know, the argument to be made that she's making this fragmentation and objectification so obvious. You know, she's drawing attention to it. She's saying, like, look, this is what we do, but how ridiculous, in a way, is this? If you think about what actually happens when you fragment a woman's body down, this is all it is it's flesh. on a plate being served up to whomever. But yeah, you know, obviously the surgeon was 99% likely that it was a man.
Yeah.
you know, at this point.
Yeah.
And so it's still about, as you said, that violence.
There's also an interesting, once you realize it's a breast, and the more we talk about sort of the object in its art historical context, you know, it being part of the surrealist movement or, you know, whatever, it's hard not to think about sculpture and the tradition of sculpture and how we can get into the formless and the abject a little bit, because I think it's important in this case. But you have this black breast on this white plate, and it's so different from like Greek sculpture with the, you know, the white smooth busts. It's not this sort of grainy textured meat.
There's so much texture to this.
But I don't know if I'm fully there yet in my thinking on how related.
We don't have to be fully there yet. You know? That's the thing, is we're just coming up
ideas. But what I would say it relates to in surrealism in that sense is that very sort of like Bataillean, Georges Bataille, you know, the, I don't know if he was actually a, would have called himself a surrealist thinker, but one of the philosophers or writers of the surrealist movement, and his ideas, once again, not sure if they're his ideas, but surrealist ideas about hautes and basses, or like high art and the low, the abject, the animal, and this idea of, you know, moving, the collapse that Bataille often talked about when he talks about form and the anform, about like moving from a visual, optical, high art, gestalt frame of operating to a olfactory, animal, low one. And this is, if you think about this in relation to Greek art, that's what it is, right? It's not the fantasy of the perfectly white, smooth, stone female bust. It's literally black, necrified, is that a word?
Yeah, sure.
Flesh.
Definitely.
You know, it's the complete opposite of that. It's severed, alone, flat on a plate, not standing upright.
And it's the opposite of how breasts were portrayed in surrealist art, you know, highly eroticized, highly sexualized, erect nipples, that kind of thing. You know, this
smooth.
Is
I mean, I
smooth
keep,
and
keep,
white.
This is not smooth. I mean, I really keep coming back to that.
No, absolutely. And but that's why it's so convincing as like a steak and ale pie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why it works as an image, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fascinating move to put it on a plate.
Oh, yeah. And we'll get to this, I think. Well, no, we can get to this now. so it's really hard. So I did a lot of reading into, like, Lee Miller's biography. And I know we shouldn't, you know, not always rely on biography, especially with women artists. But I think in this case, it's kind of important for thinking about what this image means in terms of how we understand Lee Miller. And much later in her life, after the Second World War, when she was a war correspondent, and saw some terrible, terrible things. She was there for the liberation of Dachau and took some very, you know, harrowing images there. After that, she really turned to cooking as her next career.
What do you mean by career?
She became a really well-known, like, almost like a celebrity chef.
Damn.
And so obviously seeing a breast on a plate in one of her earlier works, you can't help but think about that later career move and how it's all related, I guess.
Yeah.
And one of her specialty dishes was actually called cauliflower breasts.
Oh, my God.
And they were apparently pink, which I don't know. What do you add to cauliflower to make it pink? Like
paprika?
Beef? Oh, okay. That makes more sense.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe paprika goes like yellow when you cook it.
But probably. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But yeah. Apparently, yeah, cauliflower breasts were one of the things that she was well known for. So there's, I mean, not that it actually means anything.
No, it's
but
more
there
like
these...
it's more like an appropriately surrealist, like,
yeah,
correspondence.
It's an echo.
Yeah,
it's an echo.
It's a correspondence. It's one of those things. It's about art history and art historiography. It's hard not to think about things that happened chronologically
and
earlier in relation
not
to what happened
mention
later.
It. You know, no. It's part
I mean,
of the
even,
story.
And even if it's, even if not just with a cooking thing, I mean, I think the idea of her as a, if not a war photographer, well, I guess it's a war photographer.
Yeah.
But, you know, someone who is present to see those sort of very literal, but well, this is also a literal bodily mutilation, but of a very different sort.
A
surgery to save someone's life, ostensibly, you know, versus the horrors of Auschwitz and, the Holocaust. I mean, there's, I think there is a very interesting relationship here between, because what is making me think of, and I'm also thinking of those, you know, the famous Holocaust photos, but the distancing that is often a, welcome to photography theory 101, but it's, you know, it's often one of those the dynamics in photography, which is, it's at once an objectification of and distancing from the subject,
yeah,
even though it's giving you the most direct, indexical reflection of them that it possibly could, you know? Yeah. And that there's something almost inherently dehumanizing about it and about this image. And maybe it's reading too much into the image that it's sort of a comment on that, but it really is just a piece of meat.
You know? Exactly. And I think she's drawing attention to that and, you know, saying this is the way that, if not surrealists, treat these parts of the bodies, that society, patriarchal society, you know, treats this as a lump of meat as well, but in a very different way. You know, lump of meat as gross piece of food versus lump of meat as something like eroticized.
Intent is a tricky thing and also not necessarily all that interesting often, but it's an interesting question. I mean, I don't know that much about Lee Miller and if there's any record of how she felt in relation to the surrealists. I mean, did she see herself as objectified? I think it's important. Like, the first thing I thought of when you showed me this image and we started talking about Lee Miller was also the fact that when we think of Lee Miller, we think of the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Even though she was an artist,
yeah,
partly because we're visual, but, you know, the image that comes to mind is her as photographed by Man Ray.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So there are a couple people who, you know, have made the argument that she was, like, defined by her femininity, or, you know, a lot of her work focused on the objectification of women because mm-hmm. it happened to her over and over and over again.
The nude photos that her father took of her as a child. Yes, exactly. Right? I mean, that's...
So, before that, though, this is actually really a terrible story, and we're going to have to do a content warning. It's sexual abuse and sexual trauma. So when Lee Miller was 7, her mother had a mental breakdown of some sort, and she mm-hmm. was sent away from the family. At 7 years old, she was raped and contracted a sexually transmitted infection.
Oh my God.
At 7 years old. And, you know, she was always a really beautiful child, you know, a really pretty child, and continued to be beautiful. And, like, that was what was seen as a lot of her value as she got older. And, you know, this happened to her at such a young age, obviously traumatic. And she had to get these really painful treatments from her mother. And so her parents knew that this had happened to her when she got sent back to her parents. Literally months after that, her father was taking those nude images of her.
God. Do we know, is there any record of who raped her or no?
So somebody said it was a friend of the family.
Shocker.
Who was, you know, he was in the Navy and was back on leave or something, but I don't know for sure.
Is there any chance it could have been her father?
I
guess this is just speculation.
It's just speculation, you know, but it's apparently it happened while she was away from the family. But yeah, these images that her dad took of her are they're really upsetting. And
so I think it's something really important to pause on, is that idea of the upsetting image. I think we're going to return to the idea of an image that is upsetting quite a lot.
I think a lot in this. Yeah.
And it's a thing that's downplayed a lot in, I don't know, at least in my experience of art history and of how we talk about and grapple about images, is that sometimes they have a really powerful effect on us, and that's not just a subjective response necessarily.
I think it's framed as a subjective response, but it's a more universal subjective response than people make it out to be.
And also it's in the image.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of what I'm getting at, you know? Like it's
absolutely.
It's not just like Y person is traumatized and that's why Y person responds to X image in X way, you know.
But then this goes back to, you know, as you're saying, photography theory 101. I'm one of these people who, like, argues that it's because of, partially, not fully, but it's partially because of this idea that the photograph is indexical of the object. And so, especially if you're in the archive holding these photographs that are upsetting, that's when it becomes really, like, so there's, Margaret Olin has a book called Touching Photographs, and it's about both meanings of touching.
Mm.
You know, it's affecting. Moving and, very clever title. Yeah. And then there's...
God, I wish I was better at titles. The title for this podcast is pretty good.
Is amazing.
It took us a long time. Yeah. But,
no, know. It's...
Anyway,
it's
sorry, brilliant. Go on. Touching photographs.
So it's that idea that, like, photographs as objects have that power more so than other media, which is not always true.
It's not always true, but it definitely is true.
It is, you know, true. I mean,
I'll have to dig it up. But someone writes at some point about an archive and the rummaging through of drawers that something like photography and a photographic archive entails, you know, that they can be family photos are sort of tossed together, you know, and I think that's part of it. Also because it's the most, I think it's always been the case, obviously, because of that index kaizu, that a photo is a thing that says, I was here and this happened.
Yes. Which is why her career as a war correspondent for Vogue is so interesting for this idea of this happened, this is a real person's body. You know, that was true when she went to the liberation of the concentration camps, and that's true when she picked up this breast from a surgery and literally had it in her hand walking through Paris.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it an uncomfortable or difficult or upsetting or whatever word you want to use for that image.
And yet it's also, I mean, this is, you know, it's upsetting in a different way than a Holocaust photo is, because at the end of the day, you know, it's not a subject.
No.
It is a piece of meat. And in that way, it's an interesting commentary on the body and on art. But, you know, it is just a big old hunk of flesh, you know? It's definitely disturbing, but there's
humor to it.
Yeah.
Which I think
definitely,
is what,
there's definitely humor to it.
Which she was quite known for. And Roland Penrose talked about how she had that surrealist eye that's a mixture of horror and humor, which I think you get here just like in spades.
And that's another extension of the thing I was talking about, which is the collapse of high art onto the low, which is, you know, high art being like, you can't laugh at it. It's divine. It's the gestalt, you know, it's, and this being like this kind of ridiculous.
Yes. With capital R.
It's like objects that ask us maybe not to take them that seriously, or maybe to take them seriously and to laugh at them, which is possibly the slightly more radical interpretation.
So another one of my side projects is like humor in surgery, how that can be really complicated. And, you know, a lot of people see that as totally unnecessary or inappropriate, but lots of times it's necessary.
But also humor is inappropriate.
And that's supposed to be. Funny. That's why it's funny. It's the uncanny. It's the mundane and the, absolutely.
If you don't laugh, you cry. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And so, I think she's kind of poking fun at not only this particular situation, but also women's objectification as a whole and her particular objectification throughout her life.
Absolutely. And I think that it's a really important complication to what we were talking about earlier with the sort of two-bit feminist 101 reading of this, you know, which is like, it's like reclaiming and it's like a commentary. And it's like, well, maybe, but it's also funny.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, it's maybe I think there's this tendency in a lot of feminist scholarship to be like, women's art about these things is so serious. And so, you know, it's like against, and it's like, well, it's also just funny. I mean, it's kind of like, once again, don't cancel me this, but it's like objectification is also funny. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. It really is. It's like it's an absurd comedy, you know?
Absolutely. So there are a couple of like specific examples of Lee Miller's fragmented body parts being objectified that aren't funny to me in like the masculine fragility that they totally reveal.
Like what?
So we've got, so Man Ray just lost it when she left him, basically. And so there's this piece called Object of Destruction or Object to be Destroyed, which is a metronome, and instead of the weight, he's put a photograph of her eye.
I see, like one of those like wooden, like triangular. Here we go.
Yeah, exactly. So it's her eye. And then he wrote a legend to it with instructions of how to destroy it. And it is just so over the top emotional, like response to basically being broken up with. And you know, Lee Miller herself said it was like a wax effigy to stick needles into.
Oh yeah.
But you know, he says, put it going as fast as you can, the metronome, and then throw a hammer at it and try to destroy it in entirety.
It reminds me of that meme that's like the boy crying and it's like, feel like pure shit, just want her back, X. You know? I'm like, it's definitely like, I don't know if it's like masculine fragility or just like post-breakup fragility where you're like, no one has suffered as much as I have in the history of the world and everyone deserves to hear about my pain.
But this is
also... it's the most mundane pain.
It's the most mundane pain. And it, you know, especially if it's an artist, that's going to get blown out of all proportion. But it's also really violent in the way that he's dealing with this pain. For sure. It's a piece of her body that he's saying should be destroyed.
Well, and this is also a sidebar, and like, this really gets me into artists, TM, which, you know, we may or may not have to go into. But there's something I was thinking recently about, like, dating writers, and specifically dating writers who, like, are autobiographical in their writing, and how there's no way for you not to be, but there's no way for you not to be objectified by that relationship, as in, like, literally just turned into, like, fodder for writing, and how that's not me passing any kind of value judgment on whether or not that can turn into great art, TM, you know, whatever. But it's just, it sort of feels like that, where it's like every aspect of your life sort of serving something else that's weirdly also your ego.
It must, there's, you know, so much self-consciousness that has to go into that.
Well, because it's like, as you're feeling something, you're analyzing it.
Yeah.
Not that I can't relate to that, but I'm not out here being like, and now I'm going to make art about it.
You know? Yeah. But I mean, so many people, artists, were picking bits of Lee Miller's body. So you had him doing the eyes. He did a painting of her lips as well, like floating over these breast-shaped mounds of an observatory. that's just me thinking about breasts and reading into it. And then you've got somebody, it's an unknown artist, but did a cast of her torso. Because apparently she had one of the most beautiful torsos of all time. And people were like obsessed with her torso.
She does have great tits. Like,
look, yes,
I mean,
no, look, she does. Up.
Like, oh, and this is separately from the issue at hand, you know.
Well, I mean, absolutely. And that's the thing is, she, once again, you know, as I think it was Hillary Roberts, the curator of the Imperial War Museum, was like, she was defined by her femininity.
Yeah.
Scare quotes, you know.
Okay, so what are we looking at? It's like is that her body at the bottom?
Her body
at the
bottom.
Okay, so it's a black and white photo. It's sort of bifurcated. It's her body with the arm up, which actually reminds me of that Man Ray painting about the Minotaur. Photo, not painting. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's the exact same sort of stance. And then inverted, an exact mirror image, which also like photographic theory 101, is like this white plaster cast of her upper body.
Of her.
I wonder when this is from, because then my connection to sort of Greek sculpture is not as basic art history as it sounds.
It's like from 1942.
Okay, so it's later.
So she was in war correspondent mode, though, at this point.
Wild.
But so apparently she had this amazing torso that Man Ray and others were fascinated by.
Is it her torso in Minotaur? You know, it's like the upper half of a nude body, but it looks like a Minotaur's face.
Oh!
Yeah. You can't settle on whether it feels male or female.
Yeah.
But it looks like a bull with a mouth open and screaming. This photo is wild. I mean, I don't know if we have time to get into praying mantises and like the surrealist, but like it's very like, it's like the head of the figure is missing, and instead the body stands in for the head, but the body is the head of an animal. I love the surrealist. Like, I can't, you know, I'm just like, it's such a fascinating. I mean, like all great artists, they're a bit up there in us, you know, but like,
yeah, of course.
It's such a fascinating body of work.
Or Upley Miller's ass.
Right? No, but, and, okay, so in my, like, basic, I wrote an article, I wrote an essay in my undergrad about this and their theories of the praying mantis. Basically, we will get into the praying mantis.
Why not?
The praying mantis is, and I'm going to butcher this from memory, but it's a surrealist trope where they were a bit obsessed with the way female praying mantises eat the head of the male after copulation,
yes,
or do they?
Yes, yeah,
have sex. But anyway, and then how this sort of play between the decapitation of the body and then the body becoming the head. And so in these images, they're very praying mantis-y. They're like, there's these striations of light and dark over her, and the breasts take on this quality of being almost like bug eyes, you know, mantis eyes.
And you get that with the image of her with her own torso cast.
Yes.
Absolutely, I see what you mean.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, and it's interesting because it's an objectification so extreme that it ends up almost not being objectified.
Like, is it empowering?
It becomes abstracted.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I see. What
you know,
mean.
It's maybe not so much in this torso image, but certainly in the praying mantis ones. I mean, is it sexualized? I mean, it's an interesting question.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel necessarily erotic. I don't know.
I think. Actually, I don't know what I think is the short answer to that. To me, there's something strange about sectioning bits of her body to then represent. You know what I mean? Like, that's once again going to the fragmentation and the objectification that we're talking about. And yes, she had like an incredibly like beautiful body, and like that's fair.
And that's valid.
That's valid. That's a valid point to make. It's hard not to read into like how that must feel after years and years, especially with all that sexual trauma having built up, like to have all of this being how you're validated, or at least how part of your validation comes. I don't know if I'm just rambling, but
no, you're not rambling. I think that's one of those things that's just really hard to say without
biography.
And I mean biography as in like in the most, not biography as in as it's written, but as in her points of view.
Exactly.
Which I know often with women artists, we're lacking. Yeah. I mean, that's something I've come across, come up against a lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When I'm writing about this stuff. So it's, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, more interesting for me is about that photo of severed breast is even what it's doing with like the art historical canon, like I was saying, about whether or not it's her body that's like the Greek, you know, sculpture or not. It's still referencing that in that very
Definitely. And something about Lee Miller's breasts in particular is a glass manufacturer, the late 20s or early 30s, so around-ish the time that this was being made, made a champagne glass based off the shape of her breast.
With consent?
Yeah. I mean, I assume.
Do you know the story about her being used to advertise like
Kotex? Yes. I wanted to get there.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Let's talk about this.
Absolutely. So once again, we're thinking about consent here and like women's consent. So the question of the consent of this patient, whether they knew that this breast was leaving the operating theater to go to French Vogue, which you would never expect as a patient getting a mastectomy. And then you have this story of consent with Lee Miller herself, where she was a model and, you know, was quite well known for being a model. And she signed the model consent forms, which meant that her image could be used. And one of her images, without her knowing, was used to advertise Kotex, which it was the first time that an actual model, an actual likeness, was used to advertise period products.
Yeah.
Scandal, shock, etc.
Can we find some of those
images? Yeah.
Because I've only read about really, them. I've never seen them.
It's a really innocuous image. I'm sure. You know, it's just, what am I looking up?
Kotex. I'm looking up just Kotex.
Just Kotex.
Well, okay, while you're looking that up, I mean, it's interesting because it's like, of course it's gendered, and I'm not saying it's not, but I think it's also an interesting question of the photograph, about the photographic subject in general, and the extent to which that subject is consenting to what is being done with the photo. Because you can consent to a photo being taken, and then what happens after is completely...
You don't know how it's going to be used. You don't know what like techniques the photographer is going to use to alter it, what context they're going to put you in. And like that's part of being a model. I know. The Kotex
isn't even... Let's see. It's a picture of her.
It's just a picture of her.
I mean, it's a picture of her.
And it has the phrase, "It has women's enthusiastic approval!" Exclamation point.
She doesn't even look that enthusiastic. I don't know what the big fuss is about.
I know. She's got this nice silk-ish looking dress.
She could still claim that she wasn't that impressed by Kotex based on her expression in this picture.
But it basically ruined her modeling career.
Yeah, no, I know.
Because nobody wanted to have the Kotex girl model their clothes or their bags or... you know, their hats. And I think in the end, she was quite pleased that she ruffled so many feathers because she's a badass. So like, why not? Today, you know, there was all that fuss about what company was that used real blood in, or like red in a
I don't know, but I vaguely remember the Twitter discourse.
And it's like, come on. This was so long ago. Although, like, let's just.
Sure. But there is, I think this also maybe gets us into, they can't have used real blood. They probably just used red.
Red. Right? But that was even dramatic.
Right. No, for sure. But I guess it gets us, I mean, in a weird way, it sort of takes us back to the original photo.
Yes.
I mean, in the idea of like what isn't considered sanctioned, or like what isn't or isn't sanctioned and what is or isn't sanctioned as art as opposed to sort of advertising and what's okay within sort of one domain and not another.
Yeah. I mean, because it was okay for her to be taking images of a breast being severed in the context of the operating theater and in the hospital. You know, surgical photography was a big deal at this point. It still is. You know, it's...
Can we get into that briefly? Do you want to just give a...
Sure. So, I mean, like I said, I wish that I knew what other images Lee Miller was taking at this point. But, you know, this is the point. Surgical photography has been around for as long as photography has been, or medical photography has been around literally since the get-go of photography, because there was this whole idea that it was indexical and objective.
Yeah.
And so, oh yes, let's use this for science. Duh. Heading into, well, I guess this is 1929. So we're on the way to it becoming more professionalized, getting more public funding, to there being, you know, dedicated photographers or photography units attached to surgical wards. And so there's this idea that photography is going to be the more objective thing. But in reality, it really wasn't all that useful in a lot of contexts for the surgeons or the trainees. At least in the context that I look at it, you know, drawing, because you don't get that weird, mushy, abject, totally indecipherable flesh that you get with this photograph. If you have an artist interpreting it, they can, you know, take away the pulp and the shine and the all of that confusing viscera that you have to show in photography.
Well, there's this fetishization of the photographic that I think is a big part of, like,
yeah,
I mean, you know, Lorraine Dastan and Peter Gallison's book Objectivity, that tracks the sort of the development of medical, not a medical atlas, scientific imagery.
Scientific imagery.
From original drawings through sort of photography into sort of diagrams and this sort of removed, abstract, mathematical.
Exactly. From like being ostensibly objective to being something that you want someone to have their expert opinion interpreting the image, because that's actually more useful later.
Or shifting ideas of objectivity also. I mean, it tracks really well onto the history of documentary photography. But yeah, I mean, it's an aestheticization of that for sure. But, you know, in a way, all photographs are aestheticizations also of the object. I mean, that's, you know, they aren't really objective, just like any seeing human eye is not objective.
Nothing is objective.
Of course, there's no, you know...
But it's interesting that they have this artist who is also doing surrealist imagery and fashion photography, which nobody would think of as objective in any context, to then also doing surgical imagery, which you'd think, oh, that should be scientific. And
so to clarify, sorry, was she meant to be doing medical photography for them? Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe you said that earlier.
But like I said, I don't know where those images are.
Right.
And can you imagine that project?
I mean, they have to exist.
I know. No, actually, she wouldn't have ownership of her surgical imagery afterwards. It would stay with the hospital.
So maybe the hospital has it still, if they have archives.
All right, I'm going to Paris soon.
I'm going to come, not for any research reasons. I just want to join.
The one thing that I did want to mention was relating this work to Joe Spence and, like, later images of breast cancer and mastectomies that are more overtly claiming ownership over the woman's own body. You mentioned that.
Or even explicitly framed that way by photographer.
And so there's a very, as we were talking about consent, like there's a very different feel to this image of a woman's breast and saying like, oh, women are objectified. Like, let's bring attention to that, to, you know, a woman in the medical system pointing out how she doesn't have control, circling her breast and writing property of Joe Spence.
But it's also, it's consent, but it's also more basic than that, which is the viscerality of, you know, Lee Miller's image. And I think one of the things that's a bit wild to me sometimes is, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. It's this feeling I have where it's, as much as we're saturated by a lot of media these days, of course, far more than Lee Miller was, we're also, and as there's a lot of talk about desensitization, but you don't get art like this anymore. Am I wrong? I mean, it's so graphic. I mean, it's sanctioned in some things like war photography, but even if you think about how Instagram censors certain images and says that they're like inappropriate and stuff. I mean, the shock appeal of that Lee Miller photo, I mean, is the mastectomized, can you say that, breast?
Sure.
Sort of looks like Instagram censorship of women where you have to like blur out the nipple.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Looking at that picture, you know, the one that says property of Joe Spence.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've seen photos of sort of Instagram models or like women on Instagram where instead of putting emojis over their nipples because Instagram has a nipple ban, they like blur them out almost.
Yeah, okay. And
it
that
looks the same. And I mean, and that's, I'm sort of going more towards, I can't imagine going to a gallery today and seeing a photo like Lee Miller's photo.
Of a severed
it's
breast.
So
yeah,
shocking.
Yeah.
And not just because I think it's harder for people to get a hold of a severed breast. I feel like our sensibilities are different. And there is this sort of censorship that we may, for better or worse, it's not like, you know, it's not a value judgment, but it's that we've in some way internalized, but what isn't appropriate.
Yeah. And this feels inappropriate, Lee Miller's photograph. Is that what you're saying?
It feels shocking. I don't know if it feels inappropriate. I don't think art should be appropriate.
No. You know, I don't think so.
I think
either.
It gets to be inappropriate. It's one of the places where we do get to laugh at something that's horrifying.
Yeah.
You know, or acknowledge the abject. I mean, I don't know if it's been too long since I did surrealism that I can remember if that's a part of what they're trying to do or if they are taking themselves extremely seriously. But this doesn't feel extremely serious to me. It feels like a...
And she's not. I don't think that she is. I think, I mean, even in her, like, she makes her fashion photographs, like her Vogue photographs for American Vogue and French Vogue. Like, she even adds humor in that. And, you know, Vogue is, like, the most serious fashion magazine
you can get.
No, it's not supposed to be funny.
They're not known for their sense of humor.
But she puts that into it, which I find really weirdly,
endearing.
Is it weird that I find this photograph endearing for Lee Miller?
But this is what I'm saying, is that I think one of the things that art history teaches us also is to look at an image like this and then acknowledge and analyze all of our reactions to it.
Yeah.
Being like, okay, it kind of looks like food, and then being like, oh my God, it's a severed breast. That's a bit horrifying. Then being like, it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
And then being like, is it horrifying? And then, you know, it's...
And then learning more about her biography and being like, huh, cauliflower breast. Yeah. Wondering what that means. Yeah. And anyway, just reading 900 things into it, which is what we've done.
I feel like that's a good placement. Yeah. It's like, what is art really? You know, I mean,
we don't know.
Just like.